Hello, this is FEPS Talks, the podcast series of FEPS, the Foundation for European Progressive Studies, the social democratic think tank. My name is Laszlo Andor. I'm the Secretary General of FEPS. And I have the pleasure today to welcome in our FEPS headquarters, Professor Catherine Barnard. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for coming. For those who may not know, Catherine is a professor of EU law and employment law and a fellow and senior tutor of Trinity College in Cambridge. She's written many books, but if I can highlight one, it's titled The Substantive Law of the European Union, The Four Freedoms. It's a very catchy title. There have been several editions of this book. And those in Brussels in the law profession may know that Catherine is a member of the European Commission-funded European Labour Law Network, and she's also a deputy director of the UK in a Changing Europe, which is an authoritative non-partisan think tank which does research and provides information about all aspects of Brexit. And this is what we are interested in, all aspects of Brexit, because that's what we discussed in the last 10 years, but definitely since 2016. You have appeared on many radio programs also in the UK and university panels to discuss the causes and the consequences. But let me tell you this. I think since 2016, the way it has unfolded, it really have been a matter of huge concern, not only in Brussels, but for many other European Union countries. Has this become a kind of cautionary tale for European Union member states to avoid, you know, playing this game that the European Union is blamed for everything, and when it comes to a decision-making point, people actually believe that it was because of the EU that this and that aspect of life became just overly complicated?
I think it is a cautionary tale, and I think we do see the fact that now the UK cannot blame the EU for everything means that the responsibility for things that go well and go badly are rested at the door of the British government. But what you still see, for example, in Scotland, when things are going badly, they blame Westminster and in London. And of course, you also see other states doing just that. Macron has been blaming the EU for the difficulties he's been experiencing. Now, I think Brexit is a cautionary tale in a different way, in that I think you could say that Brexit was a bit like a canary in the coal mine. Now, of course, there were lots of reasons why people voted to leave the European Union. Quite a lot had nothing to do with the EU at all, about unhappiness with their own lot and how the state, the government, wasn't listening to them. But also there were things that were going wrong that they didn't feel the government was addressing. And I think migration actually was one of them. Now, when we talk about migration, of course, what we meant at that stage was EU migration. But as we know, on the European stage, it's not just inter-EU migration, but it's also migration from outside the EU and how to control borders. And while it was a big issue for the UK in up to 2016, what we're seeing in other member states of the EU is a really growing concern about the implications of migration. And that's why you're seeing a rise in the parties on the right.
Well, indeed, migration was a major talking point, not least for the then UK Independence Party, UKIP. But if we look at the causes of you know, unease or even unrest in the UK, the austerity policies of the Cameron government, as pursued by Osborne, the Chancellor, were also playing a role. And is it the case that migration was a kind of discussion which was easier for many than discussing austerity and developing an alternative to that?
That's really interesting. So I've been working in a place called Great Yarmouth, which is an impoverished seaside resort on the east coast of England. And it had a very large number of EU migrants working in Great Yarmouth. They're working in chicken factories and in the fields and farms around Great Yarmouth. And Great Yarmouth had the fifth highest leave vote in the United Kingdom. And it was easy to say, well, that was because of uncontrolled migration. But in fact, the coastal seaside resorts were far more heavily hit by austerity than the big metropolitan centres. And so it was a lethal cocktail, in fact, because the cake was already shrinking because of austerity. And the perception was that the cake was actually being divided up ever more thinly because there were more mouths to feed, not just local mouths, but also those who were migrating and working in Great Yarmouth. Now, of course, the picture was more complicated than that because they were the EU migrant workers who were working in Great Yarmouth, were, of course, doing jobs. So they were contributing to the economy, and they were doing jobs that British people absolutely did not want to do. And the striking thing post-Brexit is that some of those factories are closing down because they cannot get staff.
If we look back to 2016, for a variety of the reasons, but the result emerged, which eventually took the UK out of the European Union. But many of us had the impression that in reality, the British people, those 52%, they voted against something, but not necessarily for something. My question would be whether, you know, since this period, the UK has found what it wants to be or what it wants to do in a positive sense. Is there now a kind of positive definition of a kind of broad consensus among the British people?
No, it's a simple answer. I mean, you're absolutely right. The genius of the Leave campaign was that it could be all things to all men and women. And so if you wanted a sovereignty first Brexit, it was there. If you wanted a mercantilist free trading Brexit, it was there. If you wanted a big state Brexit, take back control, keep migration down, it was there. And of course, these things were often mutually exclusive or also perhaps somewhat naive in the modern world. And what we've seen post Brexit is that there is all the talk about the UK being a regulatory superpower and setting standards, this hasn't happened because the EU does it better and is more powerful. And so, in fact, there has been really very little substantive regulatory divergence from EU rules. And indeed, just before Christmas, it was the Treasury said, actually, we're not proposing to diverge further on SPS sanitary and phytosanitary matters. And so we are staying very close to the EU. The timing for Brexit couldn't be worse either, because just when the UK was talking about being an outward-looking and trading nation and entering into free trade agreements with other parts of the world, it happened to coincide when other parts of the world were closing down and looking in on themselves. And so, for example, all the talk about a trade deal with the United States, something that the EU does not have, well, that now turns out to be for the birds. Trade deal with India may happen, but the EU is also getting there too. The trade deal with Australia and New Zealand, which were seen to be quite big prizes, well, in fact, it's thought they will only deliver 0.01% of GDP compared to about 5% loss of GDP that's come about as a result of Brexit.
Creates the impression that in reality, Brexit is a journey which might never end. It might be a transition, but for a very, very long time. Somebody coins this phrase Brexiternity, that the UK governments, you know, one after the other would just continue to negotiate, to quarrel with the EU institutions, and we would never reach some kind of settled relationship between the UK and the European Union, just remain in this perpetual process, back and forth, changes, sometimes, bringing up Northern Ireland, and then the day after fish, and then migration, and then something else. How do you see this?
I certainly agree with you that Brexit is a process and not an event. I think where I would somewhat disagree with you is that there is something of a mood shift in recognizing that, in fact, the UK does need to have good relations with its closest and largest trading partner, all the more so in the light of the current geopolitical situation. And I think that there's much talk in the UK, at least, that if there is a change of government at the end of the year, so if the Conservatives are voted out and the Labour Party are voted in and they have a substantial majority, then there might be an opportunity to somewhat reset the agenda. Now, Keir Starmer has already ruled out returning to the single market and customs union. So that already rules out quite a lot of proximity. But what he has not ruled out is some role for the European Court of Justice. So his red lines are less sharp than Theresa May's red line. She was the Prime Minister who was Prime Minister in the immediate post-Brexit period. And then Boris Johnson, who also had some pretty tough red lines. Now, as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, I think we've got to give some credit where credit's due. Rishi Sunak has put a lot of personal capital into trying to come up with some solution about the Northern Ireland border. The fact that Stormont, the Northern Ireland Assembly, met for the first time in 2 years on Saturday last week, is actually an immense achievement, because things were really very bad indeed in Northern Ireland. And to see the picture of a Sinn Féin First Minister and a DUP, Democratic Unionist Party, Deputy First Minister sitting next to each other was actually a really very emotional moment and a real moment of hope for Northern Ireland. And the very fact that Rishi Sunak and Chris Heaton-Harris put so much effort into it, which will give them no credit in Westminster, is actually to their great credit. And I think the EU has also played a rather sophisticated game.
So there is damage limitation, which we can talk about. But I think if we compare it to the capacity of the United Kingdom to pursue its interest within the European Union when it was an EU member, there is no comparison. Because I think, you know, we should not forget that the United Kingdom, when it was an EU member, stayed away or had a kind of tailor-made approach to many policies. You can remember Schengen, you can recall the case of the single currency, working time directive, budget rebate. So there were many, many examples of UK kind of tailoring the EU policy to itself, which probably is not possible anymore. But in reality, my question is this. What role in this, in your view, the social questions played? Because I think the UK did not only represent and maintain a skeptical view about currency union, but also what we call the political economy of the continent, basically, a social market economy in which there is a very clear case for social policy coordination, social legislation, and that also, for some, might have been a kind of alienating factor. How did you see that in those times, and how do you see it now?
It's complicated. So you're absolutely right. Those who were strong advocates of Brexit laid a lot of blame against the EU social policy, particularly the rules on working time and the rules on agency work. So those were the two directives. And it was widely thought that once Brexit happened, the UK implementation of those rules would be ripped up and that would be the end of it. The trade union movement was also somewhat divided, because on the one hand, they appreciated the good directives that came out of the EU and were supportive of the EU, particularly when Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister, who appeared to be hell-bent on dismantling our social model. Having EU rules there to try and provide some sort of safety net seems a good thing by the trade union movement. However, the trade union movement were very upset by the Court of Justice decisions in Viking and Laval. And there was quite a strong Lexit movement. Yes. So that's Labour for exiting, or the left for exiting the EU. And the Lexit movement pointed to the decisions in Viking Laval. You remember those are the cases about the four freedoms being applied to the strike laws in Scandinavia, in Sweden and Finland. And they argued also that the Four Freedoms actually meant that the UK could employ cheap foreign labour from the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Latvia, Lithuania and so forth, and we were not training our own people. So there was quite a strong Lexit movement in the trade, amongst the trade unions too. What's happened since? What is remarkable is that, remember those working time regs and the agency work regs? They haven't been torn up. There has been quite a lot of noise about them, and recently they have been amended slightly, but the essence of the rules are still there. And even this government, the Conservative government, are saying we will maintain workers' rights. Now, it may be they're doing it for political reasons because they want to hang on to the so-called red wall seats, the seats that normally vote Labour and voted Conservative in the 2019 election. It may be that they are worried about the EU using the level playing field provisions in the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. And the level playing field provisions essentially say that if the UK diverges too significantly on social matters, that can eventually lead to a process which leads to tariffs. But the fact is, we have not seen a total demolition of what were EU employment rights.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, is it not?
Certainly for workers, it absolutely is a good thing. And the UK government would say, actually, we go further than EU law, which we do in some areas, absolutely, with new legislation coming in.
That's exactly where I would like to go, because I think there is an expectation in the European Union that every political cycle allows for some further development of employment law in the European Union. And in 2015... We worked together on a conference in Cambridge, which produced a big book, which you co-edited for a European Social Union. And I wonder how you would like to comment on this concept, because one of your co-editors, Frank van den Broeke, but also many others, maintained the discourse and the vision of a social union. Is this, in your view, an academic discourse? Or is it a kind of genuine program that can be fulfilled by more and more robust EU social policy coordination, or an EU social dimension? And I'm asking also this because of the Brexit context, that after the Brexit vote, 1 year later, the EU came forward with the European Pillar of Social Rights. In my view, this would not have been possible in such a comprehensive way without Britain deciding to leave. And at least in principle, Europe could be more coherent to go for a social union now that the British scepticism in this field does not apply.
I think you're right there. And I think the Pillar on Social Rights has delivered some good things. I mean, not least the minimum wage directive. It's still struggling somewhat because, as we know, the Platform Work Directive, which is intended to give rights to those working in the gig economy, they're really struggling to reach agreement on it. I know the Belgian presidency are really trying to pull out all the stops at the moment before essentially the curtain comes down in anticipation of the European Parliament elections. I think the EU let workers down to the extent that throughout the period of the crisis, it was quite clear that the social dimension of the EU and thus in the member states was being significantly eroded. You look at what happened in Portugal, you look at what happened in Greece. Now, of course, the argument is pragmatism. Troika had to act quickly to prop up those economies, but it did come at the price of workers. And I think the very fact that there wasn't a key and very clear commitment to some form of social union meant that the economic union was always able to trump any social considerations. I also think it's complicated by the fact that when the EU was first established, social policy was very much seen as a national competence. and the delivery of the Four Freedoms was seen as EU competence. And it was never thought the two would mix. Now, of course, that was probably naive, or maybe it was just because they had a very limited vision of what the European Economic Community, as it then was, would deliver. But with the European Union in its much more sophisticated state, which also has a single currency for the majority of the states, without having underpinning social tenets, it was always likely to be the case that social would get trampled in favour of the economic priorities. And that's exactly what we saw in the period of just after the financial crisis. And that had a legacy effect, and of course also fed into the Lexit debate that I was referring to before. Look how the EU, in a time of crisis, treats Greece. So I think it's important that the EU has a social union, a very strong social commitment, and that's where the pillar on social rights is a good thing. And the fact is it also has an action programme and it has delivered some things. The interesting question is, how far can the EU go? Has the EU actually sort of maxed out its credit card? How much further can the EU go, particularly if in the next European Parliament it's dominated by the right and the centre-right?
Well, exactly. We can ask this question in more concrete terms, because I think in the last 5 years, some would argue the EU went beyond what was expected, or what a lot of people would have assumed to be possible at all. A lot of people 5 or 6 years ago would have said that it was impossible to have a directive on minimum wage coordination. And there can be other examples as well, work-life balance, for example. So where do you think it can still evolve? What kind of examples you could give, like minimum income, for example, where there is certainly demand for the EU to act, to intervene, but of course, you know, it is also a legal debate all the time whether something is on the grounds of the existing treaty possible or not.
So I agree with you. I think, if you'd asked me 5 years ago, would we have a directive on the minimum wage, I would have laughed at you. I mean, not least the legal basis issue, which we know was difficult.
Yes.
The fact is the EU proceeded and made good progress. Now, you can see there are areas where the EU could go a bit further. So, for example, in respect of equality directives, the equality directives would be covering goods and services for those areas which are not already covered. So the directive 2078 should be pushed further. So you can tinker around the edge with existing measures. The question is, what's the next big stage? Now, the trade union movement would say, well, where the EU has really not delivered is in respect of social dialogue. But of course, again, there's a competence issue which makes it more difficult for the EU. Where I think the EU is doing something very interesting, and I think it's been unrecognised, and the EU has perhaps not recognised itself the implications for labour law, is when you're looking at the Platform Work Directive, if it gets adopted. But also if you look at things like the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act, but particularly the Digital Services Act, helping those who are not traditionally seen as workers. So people who are influencers and content creators, all of these people are selling the services online, who are so dependent on these platforms. And what happens if the platforms suspend them for whatever reason, because they've breached the community guidelines on those platforms? EU is already providing remedies to these people. But they're not singing this from the treetops to say, look, we're doing good things, not just traditional workers, but to those who are in the new world order, which is digital provision of services.
I see. So the conclusion is that social policy should not be looked at as a fringe policy, as a sector in itself, but we need to look at a broader social dimension of all EU policies, whether we speak about the single market, whether we speak about trade or the monetary union. And there is a lot to do on the social dimension of the EU as a complex system.
Absolutely. And I would say furthermore that we need to recognise that the traditional forms of work, the employer-worker divide, absolutely affects many millions of workers across the EU. But there's an awful lot of people who are now consider themselves self-employed. They may be genuinely self-employed, but they are still very dependent on certain platforms or certain work givers. So what protection are they getting? And this is where I think the Digital Services Act is interesting, because I think they get some protection under that. And so we look at, I think the problem is that we risk getting stuck in a rut that we think about employment law entirely in the context of what we saw last century, which is the sort of employer, worker, the dependency and so forth. Lots of people are in that situation, but an awful lot aren't. An increasing number of people are self-employed, pretty dependent self-employed. And therefore, we need to be thinking more broadly about who should be protected by employment law.
Thank you so much for this conclusion. I think we touched upon a lot of interesting issues, from Brexit to employment law. Professor Catherine Barnard, I hope that we will have many other opportunities as well to discuss this, how in the next cycle the social law develops, and perhaps also about the relationship of the UK and the European Union, which might indeed enter a more optimistic stage of cooperation after the elections of this year.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
Thank you.